should one pursue the spin-dependent measurements? What is the information you can get from it? Under what conditions could you possibly see something first in spin-dependent rather than spin-independent measurements?
With regard to the counting rates rather than cross-sections, are they much further away? Just you know.
We'll get to, yes. Yeah, so the per nucleon value is also...
No, not per nucleon. What I meant is like events per kilogram per day per k. Are they very far apart or not?
Maybe it will become clear from one of my slides. I don't know the answer to your question immediately. And it turns out this was totally unintentional, but it turns out that the model that seems to, within a certain clarifications that will become clear in the talk, sort of seems to us as the simplest example of something where spin dependent could really dominate over spin independent by many, many orders of magnitude, turns out to be a scenario which involves light pseudoscalars, which actually is something that both Maxime and we worked on a year earlier. So I'll say in the end a few words about how to constrain those models from actually flavor physics, which has some amusing aspects. So, and this is a slide that I should skip. So in rough terms, we understand the universe very well. It's homogeneous, isotropic, spatially flat, and expanding. And depending on how much I want to annoy an audience, so the basic paradigm, if you wish, is well established, and we are looking for corrections. And sometimes you could say that's a little bit like in flavor physics, where we know that CKM is roughly right, but 10% corrections to loop processes are still allowed.
Are you going to show us rotation curves and do it faster?
No, I'm not going to show you rotation curves.
So
it's true that in some scenarios, order one corrections are allowed in both cases. Anyway, so depending on who you talk to, there is somewhere not so much evidence that W is actually near minus one. Anyway, this doesn't matter for this talk. So there's a lot of evidence for a dark matter on different distance scales from galaxies to cosmological scales. And just about the only thing we know about dark matter is that it is a particle that we do not yet know. We know that it's non-baryonic, long-lived, neutral, and the abundance. We don't know almost any of these properties. And of course, the excitement or the possible synergy with the LHC is that if it's a weakly interacting massive particle, then we may have a chance to see it both in direct experiments and maybe at the LHC as well. So, despite some hints or anomalies, or depending on what your take is on those signals, all the evidence so far is gravitational, and there is no unambiguous confirmed direct detection signal yet. At the same time, the experimental sensitivity steadily increases, and as you'll see, it will continue for the next probably couple of decades. And most often, the focus is on spin-independent detection because there is a coherence effect on heavy nuclei that the cross-section is enhanced by A square, which immediately for A of order 100 buys you a factor of 10 to the 4. So you get a much larger cross-section for the spin-independent interaction with detectors. I should mention that uncertainties in the nuclear matrix elements is substantial, but I'm not going to talk about them. Actually, over the last year or two, there is emerging data from Lattice QCD that suggests that actually most likely because of the matrix elements with the strange quarks, it now seems like from Lattice QCD that matrix element is much smaller than it was often assumed, for example, in the Dirac Susi package. So it could be that spin-independent cross-sections are, in fact, a factor of 2 to 5 smaller than most people assume using the standard packages.
This is FRSO.
Yeah.
And I don't see how Lattice can really insist on
that. So
how does Lattice actually say anything about
it? So I think that this the most of the more credible papers are from JLQCD, so they use, I believe, Wilson fermions, and they are unquenched, and they get much smaller values than any of the model estimates or a previous, less trustworthy.
How do they reconcile it with measurements of the barium splitting, and you can measure, as you know very well, sigma nuclear, as is a prime nuclear and sigma term, and rank, SU3 invariants, and it spits you the number for MS as bar S, M sub S as bar S over
so
the
they
nuclear.
Check all that too, right?
I don't think so. I don't think they do that. I don't. I doubt that.
Yeah, so I believe that these calculations don't look at the baryon spectroscopy.
Paper, but I doubt it very much.
But there are actually two or three papers from different. Okay, anyway.
They can handle heavy fermions much better than light.
I mean, heavy fermions is just the source of these really neat stuff.
So, conclusion, if you don't want to talk about something, don't put it on your slides. Anyway, so so I'm not going to bet a significant amount of money either pro or con these results. I just think that probably it's fair to say that there are substantial uncertainties at the factor of two level.
I can say something here.
Please.
I think it matters what model we have. Like if it's a standard model Higgs mediation, then the SES bar S is. Okay, it can affect the amplitude by a factor of 2 and the cross-section by a factor of 4. If you are in a large-ish down data regime in SUSY, then you only have a big quirk and the S-quirk, roughly. And there, the amplitude can sway by a factor of, say, 5 or whatever, right? Because of the S-quirk.
I agree.
And then the cross-section by a factor of 25 or so. So it sort of depends on... Also on the microphysics.
So anything that I will say in this talk is actually, this is great to work on this subject because none of the factors of twos will really matter, although I will not intentionally make factor of two mistakes. So, and the other thing is that as you see that, so these bounds are improving continuously and the spin-independent cross-sections, so the expectation is that over the next 10 to 20 years with ton-scale experiments, and there are several proposals, one will be able to probe spin-independent scattering down to sort of 10 to the minus 48 square centimeters, which is an important scale in this problem because that's where, no matter how deep you go, the atmospheric neutrino background starts to be substantial. So for now, you can increase the limits without, essentially with zero backgrounds in principle. Whereas below that cross-section, you know that you will encounter backgrounds from scattering of atmospheric neutrinos on the detector, and no one really has a good idea how to go beyond this because the way the limits scale with exposure times whatever, exposure kilogram years is going to change to much slower. And since I can never remember, I just put this on my slides, that since some of the plots are in picobands, some are in centimeter squares, the exchange rate is 10 to the 36.
Are you sure it's atmospheric neutrinos or solar neutrinos?
I believe atmospheric.
Atmospheric flux is much smaller. I mean, the solar neutrinos, you don't get right into the sort of...
Yeah, but the energy spectrum matters.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it is... I'll check, but I'm 99% sure it's the atmospheric that people discuss as the intrinsic limitation. I can check. Let me check it at the end.
I'd say it's boring, usually, but it depends on what mass of the medium.
Yeah, and it depends on what energies you have. Okay, let me do it at the end. So up to a month ago, these were the best bounds from xenon 100 with just a few days of exposure time and CDMS. So they were down at the few times 10 to the minus 4 level. There are many other experiments not shown. For example, the Dharma claim signal, which is somewhere here. And just last month, in April, there was this result from xenon 100 which improved the limit by an order of magnitude. Actually, sorry, Dharma was, yeah, so one of them was. And just to put them next to each other, to rescale them to the same scale, so I try to line up these two plots, you really see that this is kind of an order of magnitude improvement compared to what we had before. And So this was a long-awaited result, and sort of certainly in the next couple of years, I mean, Lux has not really started yet, and Xenon will just incrementally add more data as they have more exposure time. So this is the situation with spin-independent bounds. So we are down at below 10 to the minus 44, where the sensitivity is best, around whatever 30, 40, 50 GeV dark matter mass. Sorry, Wimpass. For the spin-dependent bounds, there are different bounds. So these are direct detection experiments. For a dark matter proton, the best bound is from simple. For a dark matter neutron, the best bound is from xenon 10. And there are some more model-dependent bounds from annihilation signals in the sun, either from ice cube or super K. But the point is that these bounds have significantly larger model dependence about how dark matter annihilates than these direct detection bounds.
Is there a simple take as to why the super K bound is so weirdly shaped?
I don't know. I think, yeah, I don't know. And so the only thing that I want to focus here is that these bounds are 5-6 orders of magnitude weaker than the spin-independent ones. And if you look at the future sensitivity, this is a plot, just some proposed experiments, all spin-independent. The spin dependence I don't show because they are in kind of coming down here. So xenon 100 will improve by a factor of few over the next year or two. And in the next decade or two, the spin independence will probably maintain or maybe even increase this 5-6 orders of magnitude greater reach than to the irreducible neutrino background. And there are also proposals for the spin dependent sensitivity, actually CUP 500, maybe in the not too distant future, and that could come down to 10 to the minus 42. So that would be, again, like 6 orders of magnitude above the 10 to the minus 48 limit. And of course, I mean, predicting which of these experiments will progress on what timescale is really hard, partly because issues of funding, partly because there are real technical questions, either with the xenon or the germanium technology, about what happens when you scale them up to higher masses. So why do we bother with spin dependent? And I think that, you know, that probably each of us can give his or her answer to this question. We were just interested in asking this question, what's really the reason to push the spin-dependent measurements? And sort of the optimistic answer is that could spin-dependent dark matter cross-sections tell us something interesting? And of course, the answer is yes, because if you take any of your favorite new physics models with the dark matter candidate from MSSM to extra dimensions to little Higgs, typically, people find some correlations between the spin-independent and the spin-dependent cross-sections. And so observing what happens in nature or something that agrees or disagrees with these rough correlations, or if you see a signal with some constraints on the parameter space, could teach one a lot. Sort of maybe the pessimist approach is, what happens if no sign of spin-independent dark matter interaction occurs or is seen down to the neutrino background? Should one give up on all direct detection experiments? Is it still worth pushing the spin-dependent measurements? Could there be something to detect? So in some sense, what we were interested in asking, and we didn't really find an answer in the literature, is somehow can spin-dependent win as a first direct detection for some plausible, with someone's measure of plausibility, set of models. And so, for example, so this is one of the papers by Aaron Pierce and collaborators looking at the SUSY parameter space. But of course, in supersymmetry, you have strong constraints on the Higgs mass. And once you know, of course, we know MZ, and you have some bounds on M Higgs, then they looked at, with some constraints, the SUSY parameter space. And they call, so the left plot is not imposing the constraints from the relic density. You get stronger by the end of this talk. And the right plot is with the constraint on the relic density. And what they call a correlation is roughly that you see that most dense areas kind of have some correlation between the spin-dependent cross-section on the horizontal axis and the spin-independent on the vertical one. And you see that in most of this parameter space, roughly speaking, the spin-independent is more than 10 to the minus 5 times the spin-dependent. So almost the sort of, okay, none of these measures are well-defined, but most of the points are above this line, which would be this. Am I lying to you? No, that would be roughly the line of a 10 to the minus 5 ratio. And these points are kind of very rare relative to, or fairly rare. But of course,
if it was reality, reality's one of the dots.
Yeah, that's right. So, of course, with supersymmetry, once you are in a sufficiently general scenario, you can always have large cancellations between the different contributions. So I don't want to say that it's impossible to get spin-dependent by practically an arbitrary amount higher than spin-independent, but this is the generic situation. And you're right that one shouldn't look at probabilities just from scatter plots, and I completely agree with you. I just wanted to show you as sort of an orientation of what people in the literature say about these questions. So how can you possibly, or how could the model possibly give you dominantly or uniquely spin-dependent interaction? So if three-level interactions is exclusively spin-dependent, which one can get by looking at possible mediators and surveying which operators you generate when you go to the non-relativistic limit, there may still be, these models may be still detectable by other means. Because as we said, that the spin-independent cross-section is higher by several orders of magnitude, and this will stay like that. So in addition to finding or sort of arranging that at tree level you should get dominantly spin-dependent or exclusively spin-dependent interaction, one has to look at, and I'll explain what this is, kinematically suppressed spin-independent terms. And we also have to look at whether there are some loop-induced spin-independent contributions, because you could have two spin dependent exchanges in a loop give a spin-independent cross-section. And since the ratio is 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6 between these two measurements, a loop-suppressed spin-independent contribution could still be easier seen than the dominant three-level spin-dependent one.
So the models you showed in the previous, they didn't account for loop-induced spin-independent?
Yes, so most of, that's right. So you'll see that for the standard approach of a heavy dark matter and heavy mediator, that's okay. So the situations, actually, yeah, so people usually don't look at the loop-induced ones, except a few papers. And these kinematically suppressed terms are only relevant in certain scenarios, and we'll come to that.
When we come to this kind of plot where there's a big factor separating the two, you start worrying whether the couplings to neutrons and protons separately, right? Because there are media with different number of neutrons and protons, and that's you cannot necessarily kill both of them with a high fidelity,
Right. So there are,
because again, like I alluded to, there are two Higgses, right, and one couples to predominantly gamma quark, and so that's the other one couples.
Also, recently people started to revisit isospin breaking, and different detectors will have different compositions of up and down quarks, if you wish. So even if there is some cancellation in some detectors, it won't happen exactly the same way with other detectors. So people look at different things, and
the tone scale argon and xenon will be sensitive.
That's right. So even if one has a cancellation in one case, it's not automatic in the other. Actually, there's lots of possibilities one can play with.
So I can ask a really stupid question. I'm missing what, when you talk about spin-independent, I mean, what, in terms of Feynman diagrams, like, what different processes are we talking about? I'm a bit confused.
I'll show you operators in a minute. Okay. So it's in, what you're asking is, it when you match onto some non-relativistic operator, do you get some dependence on the nucleon spin or not?
Okay.
And So one has to look at what operators give spin-dependent scattering in a relativistic limit. And in such scenarios, will there be subleading effects which would still make possibly the spin-independent cross-sections easier to detect? And in all of this game, we will assume that the dark matter recoils off the quarks. Actually, I shouldn't have, well, like modulo the heavy quark. Actually, this is not quite right, right? Because there's the gluon matrix element with the heavy quark loops, which of course everyone includes. And that the mediator is heavy enough to act as a contact term in the non-relativistic limit, which just means that it's more than. So if the dark matter is scalar, then so some phi, then these are the possible operators that one can write down. Usually, people only consider the ones which are not kinematically suppressed. So Q is the momentum transfer between the dark matter particle and the detector. V is the velocity. Each of these things, we'll come back to it, are of order 10 to the minus 3. So both V square or Q square are typically giving 10 to the minus 6-ish suppressions. And so typically, yeah, I think that almost all, is it exclusively? Or, yeah, so things with gamma 5 will give spin-dependent interactions and operators without are spin-independent if you work out the non-relativistic limit. And some of these, what is going on here? I think this is O3 and O4, I believe, which are only present for a complex and not for real scalars.
So what are you measuring? So for the spin independent, you're measuring a flip of the detector thing, you're measuring that nucleon.
Yeah, that's what the interaction comes from.
So, but that's how you see that.
No, that's not how you see it.
The energy release, right?
Yes.
And the question is that some substance of that spin, right? So you can scatter on the spin and still keep the
input. Yeah, so you just measure the energy release and the recoil.
They,
and then,
they cannot separate on
yes.
the by the laser, whether it comes from the you recoil on the spin or recoil on the whole thing. You know.
So how do you see that you scatter out the gamma 5 operator instead of the Q bar Q operator?
From the measurement, you don't. But each measurement can be interpreted as a limit on either one. Mm-hmm. And since the spin-independent limits are much, much stronger, you don't, in terms of giving a signal, you know that when you are asking that a given constraint in some detector translates to a bound on the spin-dependent, wait, am I saying something stupid?
Yeah. Can I translate
yeah.
what John was saying? So take all these four operators and add them with roughly the same coefficients and their effective Lagrangian. Then the statement is O1 and O3 win big time just because all the signal would come from them. And O2 and O4 in the amplitude will give 1/100 roughly correction where 100 is
yes.
the number of nucleons in your nucleus.
On the other hand, if you look at detectors which are made of lighter materials, then those typically give better bounds on the spin dependent because the enhancement of the spin independent
so
is not that strong.
Every experiment is just going to give you some linear combination of these operators.
Yes.
Yeah. And two different experiments will give you two different linear combinations and you add and subtract them.
Right. So for the spin independent, you always get the best bound from the highest A detector.
Right.
On the other hand, when you look at data from lighter detector materials, then they will, just because you know from the xenon bounds, for example, on the spin-independent, you know that if you look at, for example, Q, then that the ratio of the spin-independent to spin-dependent will not be as high as for the xenon, and therefore you can get better bounds on spin-dependent. So you can play the same game from fermion dark matter and a slew of operators, some of which only exist for Majorana, some for Dirac. You can do the same for vector dark matter, and you see that for each case is the relatively a handful of them which have no suppressions and lots of them with kinematic suppressions either by V square or Q square. And for a vector dark matter, again, there are like something like 8 operators. And again, you can look at some of them only present for complex vectors. And I don't really want to The only thing that you should take home from this is that actually, so for a scalar, there is nothing which is not suppressed and spin dependent. So at leading order, here the only unsuppressed ones are spin independent, whereas for a fermion and vector dark matter, you do get things which are spin independent, sorry, spin dependent and leading order, meaning kinematically unsuppressed. So traditionally, again, this is before this wave of trying to explore our options, people disregarded the kinematically suppressed operators. So, and then for a spin-dependent interaction, there are only three operators that one has to consider, two for a fermion, one for this vector dark matter. However, as we said, a kinematically suppressed operator can still be competitive if the mediator scale is low and unsuppressed operators are absent. And I think this was first emphasized by this paper of Chang and Neil Weiner, and I don't remember who is the third author on that paper. And in fact, both of these features of some unsuppressed operators being absent and the low mediator scale is naturally present in the case of models with some spontaneously global, broken global symmetry. And in that case, one needs to consider suppressed operators with pseudo-scalar currents. These also give spin-dependent interactions, but they will have some suppressions which will turn out to be not that tremendous. No, so this relates to all these models with dark forces and there are lots of possibilities. They are approximate.
So you don't have masses with some unspecified interaction,
or is that the general story? Because then they should be light too, right?
They're light, yeah. That's their virtue.
The virtue of the mediator, also the goldstone, right? The mediator isn't the goldstone in this case, right? Or is it?
It is.
It is.
Like the axiom. Like the axiom.
All right. Yes.
Okay, so it's a virtue. Okay. Right.
Yeah. So, but... Yeah, so we don't want to stop at the level of operators because what we really wanted to do is to look at whether there is some concrete scenario where one would end up with this spin-dependent dominance from actually integrating out some mediator with renormalizable interactions so that one could imagine building a concrete model. And so this question of what interactions yield spin-dependent operators and nothing else was studied for heavy mediators by Chaco and collaborators. And they didn't include the possibility of light mediators, which makes this interesting in practice. So you can look at fermion dark matter with spin-dependent scattering, so like a Z or a Z prime exchange, or some pseudo-scalar, or some vector mediators, and you can look at what interactions you generate. By photon,
our photon.
Isn't that going to give you spin independent dominantly?
Well, that's my question. Suppose I have a very heavy fermion with a magnetic moment, right? And it will be velocity suppressed spin independent.
But I think I need a gamma 5 between the quarks on the quark side of the current.
No, it's f mu sigma mu on the dark matter, right?
Okay.
Then it couples to f mu wherever it comes from, right? So there will be a coupling to a spin due to the nucleus having a magnetic moment. That's a spin part of the current, and there will be a convective current that is orbital momentum in the scattering. But that will be down by the velocity in your
Yes.
So I don't know.
I'll define the rules of the game as we defined it. We want to, if you generate a B squared or a Q squared suppressed coupling, then we call it kind of borderline, and in our mind, so the real question is, I'll get to it on the next slide or in two slides, for us was, as we wanted to ask, I think in general it's quite easy to arrange scenarios that you get spin dependent, and then spin independent is suppressed by just a V square or a Q square. And we didn't consider them because there are a slew of those. What we wanted to ask is there a way to get even more of a suppression of the spin independent?
Okay.
So, again, boson dark matter, you can mediate it with scalars or fermions. So, now I come to these kinematically suppressed contributions. So, once you don't only retain the leading contributions, when you go to the non-relativistic limit, there are terms which are suppressed by V square, which is 10 to the minus 6, or Q square over M proton times M dark matter, which is again of order 10 to the minus 6 if Q is of order 100 MeV. And we view these, and these really occur in a slew of models, as sort of comparable to the spin-dependent to spin-independent sensitivity now, which, again, within an order of magnitude, we think that will... that looks plausible that it will stay like that for the next 10, 20 years. So if these suppressed spin-independent contributions exist, then they should lead through detectable effects, sort of roughly in the same generation of experiments. Of course, this is impossible to tell because it's, I mean, certainly factors of twos and fives are very model-dependent in this game. So, and actually, so in practice, this may be relevant to study more carefully because this is really an order of magnitude estimate. But if you want to define this game in this narrow sense, then I think that photon exchange that Maxim mentioned, or ZZ prime exchange, all of these scenarios can be shown, again, in sort of in typical scenarios. I mean, just like in supersymmetry, you can always play many contributions against each other and get values of parameters where there are huge cancellations between different terms. But if you take a model as sort of dominantly one type of interaction with one type of mediator, then typically, in all of these scenarios, you get some kinematically suppressed spin-independent scattering, which will show up at the same time, again, roughly in the same era of measurements. And the one exception that seems to occur is that if your mediator is a light pseudoscalar, then no additional contributions are generated when you go to the non-relativistic limit. And that's just what it is. So the other thing that you need to look at, besides these kinematically suppressed terms, is to see what happens with loops. And so, for example, if you consider Z exchange at tree level, then you get this spin-dependent operator. And as we alluded to before, you can easily convince yourself that if you have exchanged two of these particles and you calculate this loop, that will give a spin-independent interaction. And I think that this was first calculated, I should have put a reference here, by Olala. Yeah, Ruven, I think in 2007 maybe. So I think that, yeah, so this was first computed by Ruven. And if you plug in numbers, then you find indeed that this is again something of order, six orders of magnitude smaller than the spin-dependent one. And however, if the dark matter is some higher representations, then of course you could get less suppression from these loop diagrams than these six, seven orders of magnitude.
Well, and if dark matter is more than a matter of fermion, you can have probably vector current times vector current of the
fermion. And?
And that would be not MQ suppressed. So
that's spin independent.
So you want a vector?
If it's a vector-like,
yes.
Not vector-like, Dirac fermion dark matter.
Yes.
Then we can have a vector current, right? So
when you compute the loop, you know, you can have vector times vector.
Yes.
Which is much stronger than the one that you have then.
Yeah, so that would, again, give a much less suppressed spin independence.
That's right. That's
so
much less.
We are not interested in
it. I don't think that ever occurs for some reason. All those SU2 models, you don't get
it does. It's just not been calculated properly.
Okay, well, that's an important thing to calculate.
I don't know. Is there anything important in this game?
Among the other Dremel.
This is your game. What are you talking about?
I mean, that disillusion.
So, I think
they would have missed that, though. I mean, you would be looking for it, right?
It refers even to the Strum effect.
Yeah, definitely.
We made a comment, a throwaway comment with Ritz back in 2008. Mm-hmm. And now we left.
Yeah, you have to choose what loops you want to calculate. But we calculated some. So, of course, then... Yeah, so I agree that there are ways that the loop is less suppressed than this. And so, for example, you can look at a scalar... Sorry, what is this? Yeah, so a pseudo-scalar mediator with some scalar direct metal. And
this
again,
is also a CP violating mediation, right? Of some sort.
Sure, so.
Because the operator, if I just take a
yes.
CP constant.
So. Anyway, so you can calculate all of this, and it's not so interesting, other than that sometimes you get large coefficients because you can pick up large logs of And so when you have a pseudo-scalar mediator, there are several things that help you to suppress these loop diagrams even more. So there's an additional factor of MA square over M chi square suppression. And in addition, you expect to be these loop effects to be suppressed by also the Yukawa coupling squared. So what we concluded, and as you could see, there are lots of caveats that the light pseudo-scalar mediator, if you want something that is more than a V-square or a Q-square or a typical one-loop suppression, then this provides an example where the subleading spin-independent terms that are generated are much more severely suppressed from a leading spin-dependent interaction. And sort of one could stop there, or one could ask a question, is there some concrete models of dark matter where this would be realized? And the only ones that we know of is this axion portal scenario, which was actually written down before we ever asked ourselves this question. And then it was completely coincidental that we ended up with this conclusion that one should consider.
You're suspiciously down the hall from his
old. I know that. So you know my. I mean, so far, so we. Those of you who have been to Berkeley know that our Wednesday seminars are the internal seminars, and so my student Marat have given now two talks a year apart, explaining this axion portal model to Yasunori in the audience. But this was completely coincidental, and we were not set out to do this. So let me just say a few words about these models. And again, some of you know this better than I. So imagine that there is a new global U1X symmetry, which is spontaneously broken. And you have a new heavy fermion, which is coupled to the scalar. And you generate a fermion mass. And sort of the simplest concrete realization that they wrote down is the standard model with two Higgs doublets charged under this U1X. Or in the SUSY context, it's this Petcherik mean symmetric next to minimal supersymmetric standard model also does this with an extra singlet and imposing Petcherik mean symmetry. And it turns out that in these models, the So you can work out the conditions for the relic abundance, and it comes out roughly right to be the dark matter with sort of FA, so sort of this. We shouldn't call it the axion decay constant, but the notation in the literature is such that it's dangerously misleading. So one can get roughly the right relic abundance with these models. Yes.
Is this a real axiom in the sense that it's also solving this?
No, it's not. It just has transformation properties like if it was an axion, and couplings as if it was an axion. So, yeah, so in principle there is the field S and A if you decompose it. And so you need to worry. So the A exchange naturally gives you a spin-dependent interaction, and you need to worry whether the spin-independent with the S is negligible or not. In the original model that Yasunori and Jesse wrote down, they wanted to keep MS light because they were motivated by generating the Sommerfeld enhancement somehow, taking the hints that existed 2-3 years ago seriously. And that was actually in tension with the bounds on the spin-independent cross-section already in their paper, but it was kind of moderate and one could borderline avoid it. However, if you are willing to give up MS being light and you let it go up to maybe it's natural for it to be up at the TeV scale, sort of at the same scale where FA is, then the spin-independent cross-section is extremely small and it will never come back to be detectable. And because the A mediation is this pseudo-scalar light mediation, you will not generate a subleading spin-independent coupling that's detectable. So is the spin-dependent cross-section large enough? So you can just kind of work out what the cross-section is with the A exchange. There are some questions. I mean, there's certainly a lot of model dependence, but roughly speaking, you can get of order 10 to the minus 40 square centimeter of spin-dependent cross-sections, which are sort of an order of magnitude, or again, the factors of two floating around, so which are below the current bounds, but not necessarily much below the current bounds. And we check that if you look at the loop-induced spin-independent cross-section, it's indeed like totally in the noise. So what do we know about these models? So this is something that Maxim looked at a year ago and we looked at some time ago. Yeah, sorry. Apologies. So I'm sure you have seen many talks on this subject that these cosmic ray excesses led to a lot of model building, and there's sort of this natural, plausible scenario that the dark matter annihilates to standard model particles through light bosons, and then you can explain the cosmic ray, the claimed cosmic ray excesses.
It's a good way to fake a pulsar.
Sorry?
It's a good way to fake a pulsar. Sorry, I shouldn't have said it.
No. So I'm not even 100% convinced that it has to be a pulsar.
Oh, that's right. You're even on.
But I'm not even putting it up on my slide because then we'll get into an endless argument about something that I don't want to discuss. At least not when I have 7 minutes left. Yeah. And so, of course, the most popular scenario and maybe the most interesting is indeed these dark photons. But people looked at possible other portals, that is couplings to the standard model sector. And okay, so this is this model which we talked about before. And you guys realized that because this is an axial coupling, if you look at flavor changing neutral currents, and it's more interesting in the B sector because in the K sector there are already very strong bounds. Then there are some loop contributions which are enhanced by M-top. So there was your paper, and so I'm just going to say what we did. We wanted to look at a concrete renormalizable theory with an explicit model. So this is this Peccei-Quinn symmetric NMSSM where you can show that there is this amusing feature that the sort of the B2S, this would-be axion matrix element, is the same as the B2S would-be light CP odd Higgs cross-section in the two Higgs doublet model with top W top Higgs and top Higgs W penguins. And so this was amusing to us because we saw that we can just recycle some results from 30 years earlier. And so after realizing this, so it's kind of an amusing story that the two papers by Mark Weiss and Lawrence Hall, one of them just down the corridor, and Mark, and there is Jean-Marc Ferrer, the Masson and Gavella. So
does Hall remember that he calculated?
It's one of Larry's first papers when he was still a graduate student at Harvard. So actually, he tells me that this is when Mike taught him how to calculate loop diagrams.
Okay.
And you know, these are both of them are trustworthy authors. And we looked at so these are the diagrams they calculate, and these are the results. And then you look at them, and you type them into Mathematica, and they are not the same. It's not only that they are not the same, they have totally different singularities. So then you look at the literature. This paper has like 100 citations. This is around 50 or 60. You look at which papers cite both of them. There are about a dozen of those, and no one comments on the result being different. And So these guys were really
this
was not in the context of axions. This was really looking for a CP odd Higgs, which was still allowed to be light.
Not found either, right?
So this was without supersymmetry. This is just the two Higgs doublet model, 1981. There was no archive. The two papers are like 2 months apart in the literature. So, you know, we asked both of them, and they didn't know about the others. But none of these papers, which cited both and typically use this result because it's simpler to retype, commented on the difference. So we didn't have a choice but to recalculate everything. And to our surprise, we ended up agreeing with this formula and not with this one. And so, like, how this thing blows up as a function of when it looks totally different, but people mostly use this one. So it was kind of funny. And then we got Mark and Lawrence really worried for like a week because they were sure that Vermassarin never makes a mistake. And then when we were ready, then actually, so it turns out that what happens is that you can reconstruct what they, so replacing something in one of these logs, you can actually get these two results be the same. But then you go back and you can actually download the preprint version from the KEK library. And so it's not a typo in the publication. It's a typo in the manuscript, probably, already. But of course, none of them had their notes, so.
So we probably actually agreed, you think, and just typos. And it propagated for 30 years.
So this is all hypothetical, but probably this was the beginning when Vermassarin started doing these automated calculations, which is probably why they managed to simplify their result much more. So these guys really just calculated each of these diagrams, added up, and they simplified it to the point where they thought that, okay, this is below the threshold of where some journal would complain. They probably had some smart way of simplifying it, but probably didn't just go from Mathematica to LaTeX, and they, my guess is that they just made a mistake in the preprint, but the preprint already has, I think you have to do like two, I don't remember, we say it in a footnote, and we try to be very, very nice, and we checked it with them that they are not going to get offended, but it's amusing, but then the subsequent literature does use the wrong formula.
Question is, how late can you publish in a rep? What's the time limit?
I don't think there's
I mean, anyway, that was just, I mean, I have never encountered this with people that I know so well, but just amusement. So if you look at the Bell and the Bobard, so what are we looking for? So this A would be a narrow resonance, and maybe the simplest way to constrain it is to look at B to K or K star, And as you know, in the K-star case, there is this contribution that shoots up from the chromomagnetic pinging operator. So probably in the long run, if you look at a narrow resonance, it's probably better to constrain experimentally from the B2K than the B2K star mode. So again, just eyeballing these plots, we used this bound. I think you guys took a significantly better bound achieved.
I don't think we quote it as a bound, but as a sense.
Yeah, you quote it as a sense. That's right. So, and you know, we were trying to.
And I think they went down in searching for this.
So my understanding is that Bobar is actually now doing something where they will quote.
No, sort of. Bell has much more statistics.
Yeah, this is the Bell plot. Yeah. So, but I think that. This is extremely conservative because we didn't want to step on anyone's toes. It's clear that one could get already from the existing data a better bound. And I think that equally interesting is the fact that all these form factor uncertainties don't really matter for constraining a bump on top of a smooth distribution. So sort of how well models or lattice QCD or anyone can calculate these form factors is really not a limiting factor on being able to constrain bumps on a smooth curve. So this is something that LHCb should be able to do much, much better. And so again, if you take this concrete realization that we had, this batch Aikman symmetric two Higgs doublet model, then actually it's amusing because as a function of tangent beta and the charged Higgs boson mass, there's a region where there are cancellations between different contributions. So there is sort of an allowed region where B decays are not very constraining just because of some cancellations between some diagrams. And then there is a complementarity between the epsilon 3s decay bounds that were looked at as well. So there is still some viable part of the parameter space where such a mediator could give a dominantly spin-dependent signal. So just to conclude, most dark matter models that have dominantly spin-dependent interactions will not be much harder to see in spin-independent experiments through subleading interactions, sort of as a generic statement. It seems to us that the unique exception is when the mediator is a live pseudoscalar. An explicit model realizing such a scenario is actually there in the literature for several years now. Some of its parameter space is best probed by B decays, some other by epsilon decays. We don't claim that we have a no-lose theorem. So certainly there are several caveats to this. One of them is that, as you said, one can probably build models where either these V-square or Q-square suppressions are not 10 to the minus 6, but maybe only 10 to the minus 5. Also the loop suppressions. So this 10 to the minus 6 was kind of arbitrary in the sense that it was limiting the options. One can probably come up with scenarios which in the 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6 range, well, it is possible that spin dependent will be first seen. But if you want to conclude unambiguously that spin-dependent is the only possibility, then I don't think that there is any other simple model than this pseudo-scalar mediators, again, other than, for example, in the MSSM taking some region of parameter space where there are humongous cancellations. So thank you for your attention.
They had quite a bit of statistics on this K star L plus L minus. They came up with the claim that they see like deviation from the star model.
You mean the isospin asymmetry or the forward
backward
asymmetry?
The symmetry, right? It was like featured on their website. Like,
yes.
We see the evidence for the physics beyond star model. Has there been any movement on that since then?
I
mean, it's not happening in this model. So.
Yeah, sure. These models cannot do that, but I don't know. I think that the data is still the most current, isn't it? I am not aware of.
So there's been no more data collection at Bell, or?
Well, Bell was turned off in the summer of 2010, right? And they are upgrade. I mean, they, you know, the party line from Japan is that they have the money and they have the approval to upgrade to Bell 2 or whatever, Super KEKB. And so they switched off relatively early, partly to save sort of half a year of operating expenses to use that towards the upgrade. So I don't remember whether the forward backward asymmetry was using their full data set or not. But I think that there was another thing which was disturbing, that there was an isospin asymmetry, which was even harder to explain with new physics. So I don't know. I mean, my take on those anomalies is that now that we have relatively large confidence that there will be much. I mean, certainly LHCb can also do the K-style plus L minus. So I don't find that the most exciting thing to think about, because probably within a year or two we'll know whether it is much more sigmas or much fewer sigmas. But I think it's in the category that it could be new physics. I don't know. I don't think that anyone can say that it's inconceivable. It's like pick up. Let each of us has to pick his anomalies. Sorry?
Some are better than others.
Well, it's not so clear that. I mean, I think it is true that, for example, the top forward backward asymmetry, if it was easy to fit in some garden variety SUSY models, then it would have attracted much more attention. So it's clear that how people look at each anomaly depends on what they think as plausible or less plausible models of new physics. Sorry?